Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Shamitha Basu, a reporter in the newsroom here at WNYC, sitting in for Allison Stewart. Symbols carry power. Images carry weight. For the LGBTQ community, the rainbow flag can be a declaration, an invitation, a remembrance of history. In a new book, Queer by Design, the reader is taken through different eras in queer life and protest, from pre-liberation to the 21st century, all through the lens of visual design and symbology. I'm joined by the author, art historian, critic, and curator, Andy Campbell. Hi, Andy. Welcome to All of It.
Hi, Shamitha. Nice to be with you.
And nice to have you here. In the introduction of the book, you have this anecdote that I'd like for you to share where you had just turned 16 and you were given the keys to your parents' Chevy. And like a true teenager, you decided to go and explore what you could do. And your first stop was to go and buy a rainbow striped bumper sticker. What was going through your mind at the time?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, having to deal with the first access to mobility, you know, the first place I went was a gay bookstore in Austin called Lobo and bought a rainbow sticker with the intention of putting it on my car. And when I went out into the parking lot, I paused because all of a sudden I realized that putting the sticker on the car made me newly kind of visible in a more public way. And thus more vulnerable. And so I write about that as a moment where I had to choose between what kind of queer person in public I wanted to be, right? Did I want to be a queer person who wanted to assimilate and blend in, or did I want to be someone who stood out for my differences and who loved and really showcased my difference. And I decided, of course, to put the sticker on the car. But for me, it was it's a telling moment because design is not just some lofty thing that designers cook up in some laboratory somewhere. It is the things that touch our daily lives. And so it was important for me to explain how design had touched my life very early on as a young queer man.
And what did you ultimately decide to do?
Oh, yeah, I put the sticker on the car.
Yeah. And what happened?
Well, I mean, like, you know, I was worried that, you know, people would, you know, honk at me angrily or something. And really what I got more were kind of people honking at me and giving me, you know, like hook'em horn symbols and, you know, thumbs up and stuff. So I think, you know, my fears were a little unfounded. I came of age in a time and in an era where queer people were gaining broader visibility. And so I think I had underestimated some of the kindness and support of my fellow humans.
Mm-hmm. Listeners, we would really love to hear your stories about sporting your very first LGBTQ symbol in some way. Maybe like my guest, Andy Campbell, you bought a bumper sticker. Maybe it was a t-shirt or a rainbow flag for your yard. That's a bold first step, but maybe that was your first step. What was that experience like for you, claiming this piece of your identity and broadcasting it like this? Call us, 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. My guest is Andy Campbell, the author of Queer by Design. And your book takes us through so many different signs and symbols. Unfortunately, we can't go through all of them, but let's go through as many as we can. What do you say in the next 15 minutes?
I'm ready.
Let's start with, it feels like the appropriate place to start, the Gilbert Baker's rainbow flag, which is probably what some people think of first when they think of LGBTQ-related imagery. Can you talk a bit about the origins of the flag and the version that's on the cover of your book?
Yeah, so it's probably the most well-known symbol or icon of the LGBTQ rights movement. And it really started as a conversation between then-city supervisor Harvey Milk and Gilbert Baker, who was known in the community in San Francisco as a kind of protest drag queen. He went under the name Busty Ross and did all these really kind of fantastic
Ross.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Uh-huh. I mean, I think that name might have come after the flag, but essentially he was known for these kind of drag protest performances. And he was tasked with developing a new symbol for the gay rights movement. Harvey Milk was Unhappy with the pink triangle, which is another kind of stalwart of gay iconography because it has its roots in the Holocaust. It has its roots in Nazi Germany's kind of branding of homosexuals.
Mm-hmm.
So he and a couple of key collaborators, Lynn Siegerblom, who went by the name Fairy Argyle Rainbow, which is the best name, and James McNamara, created this really powerful symbology, an 8-color striped flag that flew in the United Nations Plaza in San Francisco, 2 gigantic flags. And ever since then, it's been mutating and changing. One of the key ideas and one of the surprises to me as I was researching the Rainbow Pride flag is how much it has actually kind of shifted and changed and how early some of those changes took place. The flag began as an 8-color flag, and within a couple years, it had been streamlined down to a 6-color flag.
Why had it been streamlined? Because I know the colors were each representative of a different theme or idea.
Yeah. Yeah. So one is, you know, I mean, they're both seemingly for purely pragmatic reasons. Gilbert Baker, after debuting the flags, went to the Paramount Flag Company and wanted to produce the flags in mass. But hot pink, which was one of the colors on the flag, was not available as a commercially produced fabric. And so if he wanted to mass produce the flags, he had to do without the pink stripe. And then in the following years, the San Francisco Gay Freedom Day Parade, Christopher Street Liberation Day Committee wanted to put the flags on either side of Market Street. And because 7 was harder to split up than 6, Baker dropped another color from the flag, which was turquoise. And that's how we got the 6-color pride flag that that most of us know today. So it seems for purely pragmatic reasons that those things were dropped.
Mm-hmm.
Those colors that were dropped, you know, pink stood for sex and turquoise stood for magic. And there are a lot of kind of queer critiques of kind of mainstream LGBTQ politics that say those are exactly the things that have kind of dropped out of LGBTQ discourse.
Mm.
So it's an interesting, you know, thinking about the design and the history of the design of the flag is an interesting way of thinking about, okay, how have queer politics changed over the course of, you know, 30, 40, 50 years?
Tell us more about the pink triangle, because you wrote how in the 80s it was sort of reclaimed as a symbol.
Yeah, so the pink triangle has its roots, as I was saying before, in the Holocaust, in Nazi Germany's use of the symbol to brand homosexual men. Lesbians actually got a black triangle, which was reserved for a lot of different categories of people, but gay men got a pink triangle, and it was really the activist group ACT UP, which was formed in response to the AIDS pandemic, that reclaimed the pink triangle as a symbol of both struggle and liberation. And what they did that was so fascinating, and their kind of iconic Silence Equals Death poster, is they turned the triangle upside down. So instead of the triangle being rested on its point, it was rested on its base, which is, you know, if you're talking about formal visual symbolic language, you know, a triangle on its base is a much more stable kind of shape or form.
Mm-hmm.
And then they added the language of silence equals death. And it was really that and the incipient use of the pink triangle by Queer Nation and a bunch of activist protest groups who were not only reclaiming visual symbology, but reclaiming language. I mean, the fact that I call myself a queer today is in no small part due to the fact that they reclaimed the term queer as something that is both political and liberatory. And it was really because of their work, their visual work, their activist work, their linguistic work, that a lot of LGBTQ identity can be kind of traced back to today.
We have some callers calling in. Marcia in Queens. Hi, you're on WNYC.
Hi. So I'm really enjoying the topic, and it's so appropriate for Pride Month. I mentioned to your screener that back in the 70s, I had a Lambda t-shirt.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, nobody knew what it was except other gay people. I was a member of the Gay Activists Alliance.
Oh, wow.
And then in 1980, I went for a job interview, and I had gotten from a jeweler on Christopher Street a gold Lambda earring that I wore. And I went to this job interview, and after the interview, the interviewer said to me, you know, you better be careful where you wear that lambda earring.
Mm.
I thought I was going to die. Of course, he was gay. I got the job. But it just, you know.
So it all it worked out for you in the end.
Well, yeah. You know, back then we were fearful about losing jobs, not getting jobs, about getting, you know, beat up, even though we were out and protesting.
Sure.
So it's so wonderful to hear about people purchasing rainbow stickers. I mean, you had to go. You couldn't just get a gay symbol anywhere back then.
Marcia, thank you so much for calling in and sharing your story. My guest is Andy Campbell, the author of Queer by Design. Andy, can you tell us a little bit more about Lambda?
Yeah, I wish I could see Marcia. I'm wearing like the biggest smile on my face. the Lambda comes out of the Gay Activist Alliance. So it was designed by Tom Dwar, and it was a symbol that was commonly found in chemistry. So its meanings actually were about change and about affecting change. So it was something that the Gay Activist Alliance, it was a symbol that the Gay Activist Alliance had really argued over and figured, you know, to some, it was too opaque. I think that goes brilliantly to the point that Marcia was making. And to some, it was a kind of new language to invest in.
Mm.
And the Lambda is one of the great early symbols of the LGBTQ liberation movement. In fact, it adorns the poster that I talk about in the introduction that's carried by Jeannie Mumford that basically kicks off the organization PFLAG. Parents, friends, and family of lesbians and gays. So it's broadly used. It was broadly disseminated. You still see it sometimes. I think on university campuses, oftentimes there are Lambda groups. Sometimes they're called Lambda groups. Sometimes they use the Lambda symbol.
Sure.
But I love all of those little eddies of history. I love symbols that both we live with today and also symbols that seem to have kind of fallen by the wayside as well.
Real quick, I want to ask you about the money stamp in the 70s and 80s and into the 90s.
Yeah.
People were stamping dollar bills with pink triangles sometimes and the words
yes.
gay money. Can you talk about this form of activism?
Gay money, or, you know, another stamp was dyke dollars, which was really kind of great. You know, that's a great example of design being kind of collectively authored, because there's not just one point of origin for that practice. It's essentially a kind of on-the-ground activist grassroots practice that accomplishes a lot of different things. So businesses, LGBTQ people would stamp, if they had a stamp, would stamp their dollars and their money and put them back into circulation. And it's a way of making visible the fact that LGBTQ people are part of the larger world, that we're part of a conversation in an economic environment. And so for some people, it was a way of showing purchase power in a way and something that leads the way to kind of niche marketing. For other people, it was another way to become visible in space without having to show up in body or kind of display your body or go out to a protest. It was a way of kind of being out in culture and getting that message, you know, to lots of different places, for it to go to many different places.
Listeners, we're taking your calls. We want to hear your stories about sporting your first LGBTQ symbol of some kind, whether it was a bumper sticker, maybe it was just a button you put on your shirt or your bag. Give us a call and tell us what that experience was like for you to, for the first time, claim a piece of your identity in this very visual way. 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. My guest is Andy Campbell. He's the author of Queer by Design. Andy, I'm thinking as I'm flipping through your book about these symbols and buttons and logos, they're a way of communicating something to members of a community, sort of like what Marcia was saying earlier, but they're also a way of communicating something to people outside that community.
Mm-hmm.
What do you want people to understand about how graphic art is used to convey messages in these ways?
Yeah, I mean, I think you just hit the nail on the head. You know, it really depends on what we're talking about, right? So, you know, a protest sign that's carried in a march or a rally or even a parade is meant to speak outward, right? It's meant to kind of address a public, which may include LGBTQ people, but also includes non-LGBTQ people. That's in dynamic tension, I think, to the signs and symbols and iconographies that we use to communicate within our own community. So things used to identify one another. I mean, this is again, kind of picking up on Marsha's point, which is that the lambda symbol was, if you knew about it, was a way of identifying who else might be, you know, queer in the room. Historically, LGBTQ people have developed many, many ways of communicating to one another through visual signs and symbols. I talk about an early example in Buffalo, New York, where some lesbians would get a star tattooed on the top of their wrist, and that star could be hidden by a watch. So it was something that wouldn't be visible during kind of normal working hours, but if revealed, would indicate that the person was of your community, was of your group. And that is, you know, that is, for me, a very productive tension in LGBTQ design. And making that visible and available to a broader audience and showing the ways in which we've communicated with each other and with a broader world has been a real joy in writing and touring around with the book.
Andy, let's take another call while you're still with us. Claiborne in Brooklyn. Hi, you're on WNYC. What's your story?
Hi, my first pink triangle was a gift from a friend, and I wear it still. It said, straight but not narrow.
That's awesome. Claiborne, thank you so much for calling in.
Bye-bye.
And we also got a tweet from Sarah, who's saying, I love what Marsha said about how hard it was to access symbols. I was in my local craft store yesterday and was remarking to myself how amazing it was to see a display of Pride gear labeled as such front and center upon entering the store. Andy, can you talk a little bit about how these symbols appear today in 2019 in our lives, perhaps differently than ever before?
Yeah, I think I'm one of a group of people, I think, within our community that at once celebrates the fact that we have this really broad visibility, that stores like Target or Starbucks or Apple, you know, are producing goods that, you know, seem to showcase LGBTQ pride. Oftentimes, the main symbol that's used is the rainbow flag. Or the six-color rainbow flag that most people are familiar with. Mm-hmm. I worry a little bit because I love the broad and vast heterogeneity of symbols that we've developed historically as a community. And I don't want to see that just kind of subsumed under one singular symbol that means all for everybody. And it can't, you know. I think we're too broad, we're too diverse, we're too unruly as a group of people to be encapsulated by simply one symbol. And so I want people to, of course, celebrate and enjoy kind of the diversity that we as LGBTQ people bring to the table. And I will never be mad at anyone who's wearing a rainbow pride flag or carrying a rainbow cup. Mm-hmm. But I want people to dig further. You know, I as a scholar, as a historian, as a queer person on the street, I want people to kind of acknowledge a kind of deep and broad history of LGBTQ life. And that's one of the reasons why I actually wrote this book, is to help educate people not only on the history of the rainbow pride flag, but also on the kind of myriad other symbols, icons, and designs that we've developed over the years. So people are likely to encounter kind of the rainbow pride flag on all manner of things, especially this month as we approach the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising. And I just want people to accept that and also to go one step further.
Let's take another few calls because we're getting a lot actually coming in. Lisa,
okay.
Lisa in Brooklyn, real quick, we're coming to you. You're on WNYC. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. I don't know if I'm supposed to turn down my radio. You can hear me, though, right?
I can hear you just fine. Yeah, tell us about your first ever symbol.
So I came out in 1979. That's a long time ago. And it wasn't like, you know, celebrating on the street kind of thing. But I did find a rhinestone triangle It's very tasteful and it's very pretty, and I wore it all the time. And I knew, and anyone who was gay knew, that it was a symbol of something, but everyone else just thought I was, you know, chic. So that was my first symbol.
Lisa, thank you for calling in. We're going to take another call from Lester in Stamford, who I understand was the founder of a PFLAG group. Hi, Lester.
Hi.
Tell us about your symbol story.
Well, I've called because I can remember 35 years ago, before PFLAG, we had a pin that just was a black pin with white figures and said POG, Parents of Gays. And that was the forerunner of PFLAG.
Lester, thank you for calling in with that. We have a tweet from a listener, Arjuna. We've been asking our listeners, what's the first time that you ever sported an LGBTQ symbol of some kind? And Arjuna says, my first sign was kissing my first boyfriend for the first time at my first Pride March in New York City. New York One filmed us. So that's a good way to declare that for the world. My guest has been Andy Campbell. His new book is Queer by Design, 50 Years of Signs, Symbols, Banners, Logos, and Graphic Art of LGBTQ. Andy, thank you for joining us on All of It.
God, thank you so much. It's just been a thrill.
After the break, Matthew Reamer and Leighton Brown, authors of We Are Everywhere, Protest, Power, and Pride in the History of Queer Liberation, will join me in the studio. This is All of It on WNYC.